I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. NASA's space shuttle program ended in 2011, but sending American astronauts into space as part of the International Space Station continues as Americans hitch a ride with their Russian counterparts. Delays to NASA's commercial crew program mean the spacecraft being created by SpaceX and Boeing will not ferry astronauts to space station this year as planned. Those flights are not expected to take place maybe until 2019 at the earliest. Joining us to talk about space travel and his experience is astronaut Daniel Burbank from Yarmouth Port. Welcome. Good to see you.
Thanks, Mindy. It's great to be with you.
So when we think back to the 1960s and 70s and the space race, it's kind of remarkable to look at where we are today with people from all over the world sharing the space in this International Space Station. Who would have thought?
Yeah. I think when we were growing up and we saw the space age dawning, I think we all expected that by now you'd have hundreds of people living in space on a regular basis. And we're not quite there, but we do have six people pretty much all the time, 24/7, 365. And they're an international crew, and they've been doing it for 20 years, just about.
I'm going to go back a little bit. You served in the Coast Guard and spent some time here in Woods Hole. When did you think, hey, I think I'd like to be an astronaut?
Yeah, I think it was So I was always interested in the space program since I was a young kid. When I was growing up, or when I was, through my early teens, right on through, we had already been flying Apollo. We moved into Skylab and all that. Although I was very interested in it and followed it, I never really thought that this was something that I could do, even as a young kid. So it wasn't until much later, when I was already an adult and flying Coast Guard helicopters and another Coast Guard fellow by the name of Bruce Melnick applied for and got selected for the astronaut program, that it really, said, geez, maybe I could do this. And that was a long time later.
Yeah, I was going to say, you were rejected twice.
Yes.
When you were accepted in 1996, you were one of 25, I think, selected from a pool of 5,000. So now it's more like a dozen or so spots out of 18,000.
Yeah.
So what do you say to young people who think, they might like this as a career?
Well, so unfortunately, it is pretty rare. So the slots to actually fly in space, it is still pretty competitive. I think by the time kids that are in school now grow up, I think it'll be a lot easier to do. It's not just the governments that are able to build spaceships. It's now commercial companies, like you mentioned before. SpaceX and Boeing are just a couple, and there's some other ones in there that are also planning on doing that. So in another 10 or 20 years, I think you're going to see a whole range of different vehicles, different means of getting into space, and it will get to the point where there'll be hundreds that are living there regularly. I'd like to think by the time, kids now grow up and are my age, it'll be commonplace to be able to choose to live on the moon or even to go to Mars.
Yeah. So you know how wild that sounds to me. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, and just going to the moon when I was a kid was science fiction.
Yeah.
So it's like it's really kind of mind-boggling. I mentioned before we went on the air that we've interviewed Sunny Williams here a couple of times, and we talked to her back, when she was at the space station in 2012. And I noticed something similar in your backgrounds. So you were both helicopter pilots.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, what is it about the skill set of helicopter pilots that translates to the skills you need to be an astronaut?
Geez, I don't know. There's, way back in the day, the people we picked to be astronauts were all almost exclusively test pilot school grads. Sonny actually did go to test pilot school. In the Coast Guard, we very rarely send people to do that. I don't know. I think the crew concept, how you operate in a helicopter, for example, where you've got four or potentially even more people on the on the spacecraft, is probably bears a closer resemblance to how you fly spacecraft than does the single-seat jet fighter traditional, community that we'd hired from way back in the day. Because, you get a pilot, you get a commander, sometimes you got a hoist operator, you might even have a rescue swimmer you're deploying down to the water, at least in the Coast Guard, for search and rescue kinds of things. And that's kind of akin to what you might have on a space shuttle or on some of the future vehicles, where you might have a pilot and a commander responsible for operating the spacecraft, and then you might have EVA crew members who are kind of like your rescue swimmers you're sending out. Everybody's kind of got a unique skill that's critical to the operation you're doing. And I think that's a lot like how we do fly spaceships.
We mentioned all these different folks from different countries living up in the space station. How do you manage living and working in these tight quarters with people from different cultures who speak different languages, all while conducting research that requires a high degree of performance?
Yeah. Well, first off, the quarters aren't as tight as you would think. So the space station is about a million-pound mass, and it's bigger than a football field. So even with a crew of six people, there'll be times where you're spending 45 minutes, 30, 40 minutes trying to find a crew member, because the modules don't just kind of, they're not just all oriented in a line. There's some that go towards the Earth, some that are in the zenith direction, some to the port or starboard. And so there's lots of places to be. And I think it could easily, you know, very comfortably have a crew of 10 or 15. What gets challenging is the life support systems. That from this engineering side, it's harder. The cultural side is kind of a different aspect. We've, you know, everybody that builds spaceships, everybody that flies these things all around the world, that we all kind of come from the same, you know, cut from the same cloth. Everybody is dyed in the wool. Space enthusiasts since they were kids, largely. And so we kind of speak that same language. The language of operations officially for the space station is English. The language of operations for a Soyuz spacecraft, which is how Americans are getting to and from space station for quite a few years now, that's Russian. So anybody that's going to fly, that's an American that's going to fly in a Soyuz or a European or Japanese or Canadian, we all have to be essentially fluent in Soyuz, or at least technical Soyuz. On board the space station, kind of when we have some downtime, we're all eating dinner together at the end of the day, depending on the proficiency level of any given crew member, we might speak a little bit of Russian. We might speak English. We probably could speak a lot of Japanese. Russian's hard for me. Japanese would be far harder. and so we all make do. Everybody, you know, all those crews before they fly, all of our families know each other. We've spent years in training, and we're kind of like brothers and sisters. Mm. And that's probably the most important part.
Yeah. On the space station, you orbit the Earth almost, 16 times in a 24-hour period.
Yeah.
So your sense of day and night can be thrown off. Can you tell us about your daily routine, what that was like?
Yeah, so the routine part's a little bit. So we basically sync the time on board space station to GMT, to Greenwich Mean Time. So we get up. So if you work in a control center in Europe, for example, you get it pretty easy. You work normal hours. And so if the space station crew will get up typically at 6 or maybe even 6:30 in the morning, GMT. And then we're going to have some time to read the mail. And the mail will be official stuff. It'll be the things, the grounds up length that you're going to have to do that day. But it'll also be, you know, emails from friends and family. May have a chance to kind of watch the news a little bit, the morning news, maybe even listen to you guys, yeah, when we get that streamed up there, which is very nice. We'll have dinner, or sorry, have breakfast together. And then we all sort of split up and head into our various activities. Some of the activities, about a third of our time will be working on maintenance things, kind of just fixing things or doing preventative maintenance on space station hardware. About a half of our time is spent doing the science that space station was built for. Some of our time will be carved out that's dedicated for every crew member, about 2 hours a day of exercise, both cardio and strength. That's really critical. We'll also, depending on the pace of operations or the things that are coming up, we may spend time preparing spacesuits for spacewalks. We may fly the big robotic arm to capture a space vehicle that's just brought up some food and supplies to station. And then split up throughout the day, whenever we get a few minutes, almost everybody to a person will carve out a little bit of time for themselves at the window, which is the best part about being there.
I would say at the window. Now, we've seen photographs of this, and it's so beautiful. But another astronaut we've had on was Pierce Sellers, and it's nothing like, and I think Sonny said, there's nothing like being actually there. It's hard to put into words, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And all the pictures you take, and the cameras are great. The windows are in really good condition as well, generally. But the cameras, we're taking pictures through about 4 inches of glass, multiple pressure panes, thermal panes maybe, and scratch panes, things like that. But when you're there, and it's the emotional impact of you watching the Earth scroll by at 17,000 miles an hour is an aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that the cameras, as good as they are, aren't as good as our human eye. Mm-hmm. And then if you can get a chance to go outside and not look at the Earth through 4 inches of glass, but look through an eighth of an inch of polycarbonate visor on your EVA helmet, your spacewalking helmet, that's another world entirely.
Which you have done.
Yeah, yeah.
What stood out to you? I mean, you know, you're looking down, you're not seeing borders, you know.
Yeah.
What stood out to you?
Well, so there's a couple aspects of that. So you don't see borders. That is true. One thing that's surprising to me, we don't really think about it this way, but we have a planet of 7 billion people. You know, it's an 8,000-mile rock, planet Earth. And it's got a lot of water. It's got a lot of sand. It's got a lot of people. But during the daytime, it's almost impossible from the vantage point of 400-kilometer altitude or 250-mile altitude to know that, even see evidence of human beings here. Mm-hmm. So you don't see the strife. You don't see all the difficulties in the various places where we fight over territory or fight over culture and other things around the Earth. You don't see that, but you don't even see the evidence of humans until the sun sets. And when the sun sets, the whole planet comes alive in electricity, you know, which it's an electric planet. You see all the population centers, you know, that way. So that's one thing that's pretty striking. The other thing that you never can get out of your brain is that this is your home. It's right outside your window. It's always there. The emotional impact and comfort of that, knowing that your family's there, knowing they're just, 30 minutes away. Next time you get a comm pass, you can give them a quick call or something. That's a very different kind of a psychological environment to be in than it would be to watch Earth dwindle into, you know, a tiny point of light indistinguishable from the stars as you make your way to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. That's the kind of thing. That'll be a challenge, a different kind of challenge for us.
And I know there's a couple of years of training and all to prepare you. They must prepare you somehow for that emotional, because do they talk to you about that? Like, this is going to be emotional when you get up there?
Well, I don't know. We don't, you know, amongst ourselves, we don't spend a lot of time talking. It's almost like the veterans who have flown. We sort of want to just kind of rock back on our heels and watch the expression in the faces of the rookies that haven't yet. You know, there's that part of it. We have a huge team of folks on the ground that do a lot of psychological support, and they're the ones that would uplink audios of your program or NPR or any of the other things, and we get video, we get home movies, we get lots of other things. They also work with the science community to try to figure out, and the operational community, to try to figure out a way that we can replicate the emotional impact, the psychological challenges of a Mars type or an exploration class mission on board space station, the kind of things you might do, for example. It's not just Earth being small. I mean, you could kind of replicate that by just closing the windows, I guess, right? You also have the additional challenge of the comm delay. So here it's always real time. Whenever, you know, you might, you know, do something to tape, but when you're talking with somebody, it's always very real time, and that's how our communication is on board space station. If you're going to Mars and you're at the most distant point, it's going to be 20 minutes each way. Mm. In fact, there may be times when you have no comm at all. So there's that aspect of it. I don't know that any of the, and one other key thing is that the space station, it's very challenging to keep 1 million pounds of hardware working well. We find that out almost daily, and you have to be pretty good at fixing things. But we always know in the back of our mind, and the ground always knows, that they are a couple of months away at most from uplinking or uploading or shipping up brand new pieces and parts to fix things. That's a whole different ballgame than if you're on a trip to Mars on an outbound leg and you know you can't even come back to Earth for hundreds of days, you know, mm-hmm. 2 years, maybe even 3 years. So we have to figure out a way to make, you know, have very talented crews that can fix things, figure out a way to be very, very common in the hardware we have, figure out a way to have the crew be autonomous from the ground. Not only can you not necessarily put your hands on the part that you need to replace the thing, but you don't even have necessarily real-time support to say, oh, by the way, this is the thing that needs to be replaced. So you're on your own.
Scary thoughts in some way. Yeah. We're important. Talking with astronaut Daniel Burbank. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with astronaut Dan Burbank about life in space, and we'll talk a little about the future of the space program. I'm wondering, when you were there, what were some of the more interesting or unusual experiments that were conducted? Most of it's a lot of engineering sort of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But there's also, you're looking at, like, I know when Pierre Sellers was there, it was climate change. There's all kinds of different things that you're researching when you're there.
Yeah.
What about when you were there? What was some of the things that stood out to you?
So there's a couple of things that are, you know, a lot of the science that's done in space station can be tele-remotely or tele-robotically or tele-operated from the ground. So in a lot of cases, you know, the crew would need to be there to activate an experiment, maybe to change out samples. And in some cases, and some of the most enjoyable ones, I think, from the crew's perspective, actually get to interact as a co-investigator or collaborator with the science community on the ground. So that's kind of a different thing than we did in the shuttle. So that some of the fluid physics experiments, some of the combustion experiments, those are the sort of things. So we want to figure out how do fluids behave in space, because it's important from a propulsion feed system, understanding how you can more efficiently get all the fuel you need out of a fuel tank, for example, in a feed system. The environmental control piece of it, it's really important. We are uber recyclers. So on space station, we're forced by the physics of the problem. That is, every pound you put in space takes about 20 to 25 pounds of high explosive rocket fuel to get it to space. Not really to get it to space, but to get it to space at the magic speed it needs to be to stay in space. So the mass fractions really are pretty daunting. So all the water that you drink, all the water you ingest that comes out of you through all the normal means, be it urine or sweat or just the moisture in your exhalation, we need to reclaim as much of that as possible. We need to turn today's orange juice into tomorrow's orange juice, for example. But the system that does that, the fluid purification and transport system that incorporates all of that, that it makes that possible, that frankly makes space station even viable from a logistics standpoint, is really finicky, and it's really quirky, and it requires us to understand in a better way how to, in a passive way, transport fluids very efficiently. So there's a lot of experiments that we do on space station you can't replicate in a 1G environment that involve that. Another fun experiment we do up there, and there's a group of folks up at MIT and also in collaboration with Ames Research Center, NASA Center on the West Coast, that have devised a series of basically volleyball-sized satellites that we can do a lot of testing. And these can be operated and programmed by the ground. We can interact with them on board. But they're basically able to position themselves in the three-dimensional internal space of a space station, orient themselves relative to each other. We can practice docking mechanisms, all kinds of different things. But they're like pets. They're like the coolest, smartest, neatest pets. And they're flown really by lots of smart kids on the ground and engineers that are helping us to figure out how to do, how to operate whole fleets of these kinds of satellites to do things from inspecting the space station to potentially doing power generation and other kinds of things in, you know, in the greater expanse of space.
Yeah. So, I was going to say, it seems like it's not only leading to what could be life on Mars or the moon, as you say, but it sounds like these are applications we could use here on Earth
as well.
Which is really fascinating. Yeah. I mean, to be able to take all that moisture and recycle it is pretty amazing.
It's ironic. You know, here we are, a planet full of water. Everywhere you look, it seems, when you look down from space station, you see water, and yet how many people die of thirst, and there's no reason for that. So the same technology that we're forced to by the physics of the space problem, we have to be uber recyclers. That same technology is used in disaster areas all around the world right now to purify water. So we get a good secondary benefit from it.
What's the adjustment like when you get to the space station and living in that microgravity environment?
Yeah. So going there is always going to be strange. And even if you've been there before, you're going to be a klutz for a while. if you got a crew on board space station and a visiting crew is coming up, we essentially batten down the hatches and latch things down because you're not efficient. So just moving from point A to point B, where we might have staged all different kinds of little cameras and devices and things just hanging on by a couple of just a couple of tiny pieces of Velcro, that won't do if a crew member is like a ping pong ball bouncing off the walls in the way. So it used to be that you'd have a big shuttle crew would come aboard and you could find the shuttle crew members because churning in their wake behind them would be those cameras and those the silverware and things like that. So all of us are a little bit clumsy there, but it's amazing how quickly you basically get your space legs. And in a matter of a couple of weeks, people are incredibly efficient, almost world-class gymnasts, you know, to that level.
The videos, look really kind of fun. And you guys do have a little fun up there with that. But even before that, I kind of jumped ahead. Yeah. The first time you took off, tell us what that was like, what that feeling is like.
So my first time launching to space was on board a space shuttle. And we used to say that it was almost a badge of honor. We had a lot of astronauts back in the day, 160 or so, when we were flying shuttles on a regular basis. We would fly frequently. We would fly for short duration. Now we fly much less frequently, but we fly 4 or 5 or even 10 careers worth of shuttle days in space in the course of just a mission on board space station. So it's a different era. But back in those days, the shuttles would fly very, very frequently. And I had never seen a shuttle launch before I felt my first. Mm-hmm. So that was, and I'd spent most of my time leading up to that working in Russia on some of their hardware, done the test and evaluation work. So I was kind of more of a Russian hardware specialist at that point in my career than I was a shuttle specialist. So you're sitting on the pad. First I would tell you this. when you first go out to see the shuttle, it's a couple of times before launch in the month or so before. Every time you go there, the vehicle is out there and it's crawling with specialists and engineers that are doing various work, and the crew will show up in their blue flight suits and we'll be in the way. But there's things we need to see. You know, there's things we just need to learn about this vehicle, which will be our home and our spaceship. But you're very much in the way, but there are people everywhere and you're the least useful at that stage in the game. It's kind of curious that way. On launch day, The vehicle's already been fueled up. You come out in what's called the Astrovan, and you pull up to the base of the pad, and all those people are gone. Nobody is anywhere near. They're miles away in bunkers or even further away and, you know, in safety. And the vehicle, unlike the days before launch, it feels like this living thing. There's this cryogenic, you know, fog that's pouring off the external tank, swirling around at the base of the pad. It's kind of popping and creaking because of the, again, the cryogenic, you know, the thermal expansion and contraction of the various components. And you get the sense, you get a really powerful visceral sense of all this energy bottled up just waiting to, you know, leap off the Earth. So you get all strapped in, and those last couple of people that helped you, they all leave and make their way to the safety. And then you're sitting there, and we have about an hour or so to do just kind of mundane checks, comm checks, various other things. And then you power up the systems one by one, and then it gets more and more real. And then when the hydraulic power units are fired up, you hear, you know, you've got a helmet on, so you don't hear very, very well. But you start, you know, the vehicle gets bumped and jostled around as we maneuver the engine bells and do various things like that to check things out. The space shuttle main engines are then started 6 seconds before launch. And we do a similar thing with the Soyuz and will for other vehicles where you gradually throttle them up and see how they behave before you decide to do whatever the thing is that can't be undone. In the case of the shuttle, it's the lighting of the solid rocket booster. So you don't want to, because you can't turn them off. So after about 6 seconds of running, you're laying on your back, you're looking at the ceiling. That's 6 seconds of thrust on the space shuttle main engines because of the location of those engine bells relative to the attach point. Bends the whole stack, and you move towards your feet about 3 feet.
Wow.
And then you flow back, just as it bounces off, you know, the structure stiffens, and as you bounce off that furthest deflection point, and as the shuttle comes back to the vertical, that's when the SRBs fire. And it's this most amazing thing. It's like somebody were to hit the back of your seat with a baseball bat. It's so abrupt, you know, leaping off the pad, the sensation you get. By the time you clear the pad, you're going 100 miles an hour straight up. You're going through the speed of sound in 40 seconds, and you're in space in minutes. Mm. And it is the most stunning, exhilarating experience and defies words description, I'm afraid.
What about the adjustment returning to Earth? We talked about kind of coming up there, coming back. You know, you kind of think things will float when they don't.
Yeah.
So you're what, shaving cream in the morning? Oh, it hit the floor.
It's funny. There's a story along those lines. So in space, there's a Russian story. I can't remember how you put it in Russian, but there's basically a joke that talks about, like, whenever the Russians finish a flight, there'll be a welcome ceremony and there'll be a big banquet spread out on the table, and there'll be everybody dressed up in suits all around the table. It'll be the bosses and the families and the crew, and they'll be more or less indistinguishable, but everybody's all there, and you're a little bit of toasting maybe, but there's a, you know, grazing on all the different food that'll be there. And the joke is, how do you know which ones are the crew members, which one are the cosmonauts or astronauts? And they're the ones that keep tucking their fork and their knife underneath their plate. It's unnatural for you, after you get back from space, everything always wants to fly around. So it's unnatural for you to just set anything on a surface because you expect it just to launch off and be doing its own thing. That, you know, you figure that out after dropping a few things here and there. But every now and then, a couple of weeks after you got back, you might forget. And I was shaving one morning and put a can of shaving cream right out in front of me, in front of the mirror, let go of it, fully expecting it to be floating there in front of me. And
that's really funny. Now, did you find it hard to sleep? I know some people find it hard to sleep.
Yeah, I didn't. I slept pretty well there. Some people sleep in different ways. We have a crew quarters, each of us, which is a kind of a phone booth, for those who remember what those are. Phone booth size, you know, little thing. And you got a sleeping bag that's attached to usually to the wall bulkhead. A lot of people some people want to sleep strapped in kind of securely. Some people even want to have their head against a pillow. So there's different configurations of that where you'll have a band over your forehead pushing it against a pillow because that seems to be a more natural way to sleep. In my case, it was kind of nice actually to sleep completely unconstrained sometimes. Mm-hmm. So many times I would sleep not even in the sleeping bag, but floating in the open volume of this, you know, very, very like refrigerator size, you know, crew quarters, doing like slow motion human racquetball, just bounce slowly drifting up and drifting back. And it's great. It's like the softest bed in the world.
Oh. So what do you eat in space?
So we eat a lot of the same things we eat down here. The folks that actually supply the food do a wonderful job. So even some of the things that you would not think would be appetizing when stored for a long period of time or dehydrated, they do an amazing job. So we shrimp cocktail, even that would be one that I would not have thought you could, you know, actually have stored for months. And so that's a rehydratable, and it's got horseradish that's almost, I don't know, it's almost industrial strength. It's you almost cannot eat it on planet Earth. Your taste changes a little bit in space, I think we believe, because of fluid shift, where everybody's kind of just feels a little bit stuffy, almost yet like I had a little bit of a cold. So up there, it's just about the right strength to kind of clear things out, I think. But steak, we have steak up there. Pizza is a hard one. We try to make do and make our own little pizzas using tortilla bread. And then, you know, with sauce and various things
like that.
No pizza
oven. That's the secret.
We don't have pizza. Yeah. So there are a few things we can do. There have an ice cream up there occasionally. We've got we got ways that we can refrigerate and even freeze things. So, yeah.
We're talking with astronaut Dan Burbank. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with astronaut Dan Burbank about space, what it's like to go to space, live in space, and potential for the future of space. I want to ask you about that. So what about the status as leaders in the space program? The plan to replace the shuttle program with the Orion projects, its first trip won't happen until maybe 2023, they're saying now. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, there are two private companies working on creating spacecraft that have run into delays. So where do you see the future of America's space program heading?
Yeah, so I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, it's hard. In a perfect world, we would have retired the space shuttle after we had already completed the development of a new vehicle. So the reality is it's really difficult and very expensive to create a new vehicle. So NASA has very purposely contracted to two private companies, and SpaceX with their Dragon spacecraft, Crew Dragon, and Boeing with their Starliner spacecraft. We've contracted both of them to provide low Earth orbit access, that is Earth to low Earth orbit. And then NASA has turned its attention to deep space destinations. So the Space Launch System and the Orion spacecraft and the associated other components of that architecture basically allow you to get to deep space. And I think it's probably an appropriate thing. You know, NASA is partnering with those companies, SpaceX and Boeing, and other companies as well, and helping them by giving them some of the technology we had already developed. And I think that's the right thing. As soon as the technology becomes more and more viable, where a company can make money off of it, not just with, you know, contracted flights to the government, but also to private citizens, then you suddenly change the entire dynamic of spaceflight. If we had continued flying airliners back in the dawn of the aviation age, for example, if only the government built those airliners, none of us would be frequent flyers. There would be no such thing as that. So it's by virtue of, you know, once the technology is matured, hand it off to the private sector, let them go ahead and develop it and make it marketable elsewhere. And then the government should do the high risk, really hard, and low return on investment in the near term kinds of things. So deep space, that's the right thing. We would have loved to have had those two vehicles flying in the 2016 timeframe even. Right now, we're thinking 2018 late, possibly for the first uncrewed test flight for both of those. And in early 2019 is our hope to be flying those. On the Orion vehicle for the deep space, we just completed a study where we're evaluating whether or not this very next mission coming up, we could put a crew on that. You know, the current plan had been no crew on that, and then the subsequent mission would have the first deep space exploration crews. So we're still, you know, the jury's still out on whether we think that's really the right path to do it, and we'll see what happens. But that vehicle ought to be flying in either the crewed or non-crewed variant in the 2019, at the earliest, early 2020 timeframe. So that's our hope. It's just a hard business.
Yeah. And now, if you had your dithers, would you be on that first deep space exploration?
I think there's none of us worth our salt that wouldn't say. They just love to do that. You know, the things I'm doing right now, and all of us. Yeah, I remember when I first came to NASA, there was one of the old veterans, that was their Story Musgrave. He would, you know, do these welcome talks. We'd have all the crew, all the new astronaut candidates would show up, and kind of this would be an opportunity for the graybeards to tell us what it's going to be like. And so he had asked us, he goes, okay, how many people here joined the space program to fly in space? And everybody's arms shot up like this. And they said, okay, well, then here, you need to know that as of this point in time, I have more years at NASA than days in space. And he'd been there probably 20 years or something. So the point of that was that, you know, most of the time we're not really flying those vehicles. We're doing the same kind of work that the engineers and technicians are doing to make it possible to fly in space. We do longer missions right now. So I guess we do accumulate lots and lots of days in space, you know, typically, but we don't fly as often as we would like. I think the exploration missions are great. I personally loved being on space station. I loved being up there and again, doing the science that it's made, you know, that this thing was made to do. And doing this in an international way and kind of showing the world, hey, these are the things that great countries can do when they work together. It can be very frustrating sometimes when you're up there, we're all sitting around the dinner table looking out, you know, at that view out the cupola, for example, thinking of all the difficult, you know, the difficulties we have down on planet Earth and wondering why in the world that should be, right. You know, when this is one tiny little place in a universe full of billions and billions of places.
Yeah, well, even when you think back to the 1960s, if you could look into that crystal ball and see we're working with the Russians.
Yeah, how could that be?
How could that be?
And
yeah,
we are.
Yeah. And since 2000, there have been people continuously living up at the space station, and I think about 6 month stints. And I'm wondering about the health effects of living in space, loss of calcium, exposure to radiation.
Yeah.
I would imagine as you go farther out, we're going to discover lots of other things. But talk about just in the space station, how do you monitor that, and does it concern you?
So we've on the U.S. side, a lot of our science is, or a good chunk of it, the life science part anyways, is geared towards how to keep humans healthy and productive in space long enough so that we can responsibly decide to launch a crew to Mars, for example. So some of the things that we thought that were showstoppers along those lines a few years ago included bone loss. So if you went to space, as soon as the engines quit, begin a transition, and you essentially become a creature of space. Your body adapts to that environment. Our bones are inappropriately strong right now, sitting right here for space flight. There's no reason to have all those resources in your body tied up in the minerals and calcium in your bone. So what ends up happening is if you're not doing strength exercises, you lose bone at about 10 times the rate of somebody with osteoporosis. So you're losing about 2% a month. And if you spend 6 months on space station, and you didn't even have to do that. If you flew on shuttles, people were coming back, and if they didn't exercise a lot and were a little bit too eager to get back and running, we're finding that we're getting stress fractures in the bones of their feet. So now we've got a piece of gear on space station called the Advanced Resistive Exercise Device. It's a big, it's not all that big relative to a normal professional gym, but it's got nearly all the capability of a professional gym and a tiny compact gizmo that can generate loads up to, you know, hundreds of pounds, even 600 pounds, you know, if you want it. We're finding that people are coming back now with no bone loss or virtually no bone loss. So that problem, which we thought was debilitating and a great threat to deep space exploration, no longer is. Radiation is a big deal, and we are protected when we fly on space station and in low Earth orbit in general from the Earth's magnetosphere. So essentially the Earth's magnetic field is providing a huge amount of shielding for space station, but we still get a lot more radiation than somebody does here on planet Earth, even somebody that works in a nuclear power industry. So that is a concern, and how you shield from that in a good way is that continues to be an issue. We discovered something a couple of years ago, which is a new threat, which we didn't know even after decades, you know, nearly half a century of flying in space. And that was that some crew members were coming back and they were having pretty severe impact in their vision, maybe up to upwards of a half or even a full diopter of vision shift. And it was apparently being caused, although the root cause isn't fully understood yet, but by a deformation in the eye. It seems to be that elevated intracranial pressure was pushing the back of the eye forward, and that structural change wasn't getting better. Mm. And it's something that I think some crew members would fly in space in the past, come back and just need glasses and just kind of wrote that off as I'm getting old, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet there's a subset that are having that issue. So trying to understand what the root cause is and fix it is a big challenge. Everybody that flies in space, despite an hour of cardio every day, still loses about 20 to 25% of the stroke volume of their heart. The heart actually gets smaller.
Wow.
It just doesn't, you know, the time that you exercise on a machine like that doesn't replace the time that we are just experienced fighting the force of gravity with our heart fighting against that, pushing the blood around our body. We don't have as much blood in space because you don't need it to push around. So that remains a bit of a challenge.
So in order to become an astronaut, you undergo grueling physical tests, including swimming, all kinds of things. So what does that mean for civilians who think they might want to go into space, looking at some of these potential health impacts? Will they have to train like the astronauts do now to be able to take that flight?
Yeah, it's not terribly, terribly grueling. I think in the early days it might have been for the Mercury astronauts and the first couple of Gemini and Apollo crews, the classes we selected back then. You know, most of the people, if people are reasonably healthy, if they're exercising and, you know, with cardio, maybe runners, maybe swimmers and strength, they're probably healthy enough to be able to do the kinds of things we do in space. Spacewalking is a little bit more physically challenging. So in general, I would just be an advocate for all of us not being couch potatoes and exercising more than we could. I think quite famously recently, Richard Branson is promised to launch Stephen Hawking on one of those suborbital missions to microgravity. And there'll be a lot of acceleration when that vehicle, that spacecraft, is dropped off of its carrier airplane, and then the engine, you know, kicks in to take it up to a very high apogee, and that'll be microgravity after that, and then it'll be nearly 1G at most on the way back. But there'll still be, you know, 3, probably 4, maybe G's worth of acceleration. But that's within the capability of even somebody like Stephen Hawking to do. And I'm going to be delighted to see him fly.
I'd be delighted to see him. He would be, I'm sure, delighted to see him fly.
No doubt.
All right. So I have some sort of fun questions to finish out our last few minutes. Okay. When you guys are up there looking out the window, do you play geography?
Yeah, we do. We all kind of become pretty good geographers in general. You know, actually, everybody on any of my missions within a couple of weeks, if they've never been to the Cape, all become huge fans of Cape Cod. It is very distinct. You know, it's easy to pick out, and we take, you know, disproportionately high number of photographs of this beautiful part of the world. But yeah, we do. We all, everybody, you know, everybody kind of competes with each other in that respect.
And you play the guitar. I saw a photo of you in space with your guitar. Yeah. What was it like to play the guitar in space?
Oh, so it was amazing. So the guitar is kind of small. The guitar doesn't have any amplification. It would be great if it was a little bit louder. The normal noise level inside the space station is a little bit quieter, but very similar in sound characteristic to being in an airliner up at altitude. So it's 50, maybe 55 even decibels. So that's pretty quiet guitar. But one of the best places to play it, there's actually two pretty good ones. One's the airlock, which we do our spacewalks out of, which is kind of like this little echo chamber. And then there's also the cupola, which is like the best place in the world or best place on space station to get inspiration, because you're watching the Earth go by, 2,000 miles in all directions, you know, beneath you. And it's actually a nice little, again, echo chamber kind of a thing. So you actually, it's a good place to play. We got a keyboard. I think we have a saxophone up there right now. We've had flutes. Oh, we've had bagpipes. I don't even know. Lots and lots of instruments.
Speaking of that, it seems that there are some astronauts who are pretty musically inclined. You, I think, I don't know if you still are, we're part of the band Max Q, which is made up entirely of astronauts.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Tell us about that. What's that all? I don't think I'd heard about that before.
Yeah, so Max Q is a reference to Q is aerodynamic pressure in a famous aeronautics equation. And basically, it is the maximum Q. That is the point on a shuttle or any spacecraft's launch when you reach the maximum aerodynamic pressure. It roughly correlates to going through the speed of sound. It's that buildup of the shockwave and aeroacoustic, you know, vibration. But it also really means noise. And so that band is all about noise. You know, none of us that play in Max Q claim to be virtuoso, you know, musicians, but we have an awful lot of fun.
So where do you play?
So we play, we've played all over. We haven't played in about a year, so I say we play all over. We've played at lots of NASA centers around the country. We've played at a couple space museums. We've played we played in Canada once as well. And then we play in a couple different places that are down in the Houston area. And
that's where you're stationed most of the time. Astronaut Daniel Burbank is going to be talking today, 3 p.m. at the Tilden Arts Center at Cape Cod Community College. So nice to have you here. I really enjoyed our interview. Thanks so much for coming in.
You bet, Mindy. It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.